from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 12 days ago, Egyptian scholar Imad Shaheen was sentenced to death by a court in Cairo. Lucky for him, he had already fled the country. The same day, Egypt's freely elected, then deposed President Mohamed Morsi, and more than 100 others received the same sentence, death. Imad Shaheen has thought a lot about what's happened to his homeland, Egypt, from the dreams of Tahrir Square and the Arab Spring to today's new rulers, about an entire region in fierce flux right now and America's role there. This hour on Point, Imad Shaheen, a serious man, a condemned man on the Middle East and America now. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you think the U.S. can, should, help steer the Middle East through this time of turmoil? And if the answer is yes, steer in what direction? Through ISIS, Iran, Israel, the Saudis, Egypt? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me from Washington is Imad Shaheen, Egyptian scholar, now under a death sentence in his home country, a very accomplished man, professor of public policy at the American University in Cairo, visiting professor of political science, School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, editor-in-chief of the Oxford Encyclopedia of Islam and Politics. He was the Henry R. Luce Associate Professor of Religion, Conflict, and Peacebuilding at Notre Dame. He's been a visiting scholar at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, at Columbia University, at the Woodrow Wilson International Center, got his Ph.D. at Johns Hopkins. He's author, co-author, co-editor of 6 books on democracy, Islam, and more in the Middle East. And today he is, according to the Egyptian government, Defendant 33, guilty of espionage and conspiring to undermine Egypt's national security, and sentenced to death. Imad Shaheen, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
When did it become clear that this sentence would be handed down?
If you look back at the past 2 years and the so many irrational policies and draconian measures that this military-backed government has taken, I think it is was expected. It didn't come as a shock to me. This regime has been really trying to crush any voice of dissent for quite some time now, and it have targeted, you know, any dissident. I mean, any dissent from youth, from young, from protesters, from peaceful protesters. And it has also been using the judiciary as a tool to eliminate opponents. So it was not a surprise.
I want to talk about the whole region, but Egypt, of course, is right at the heart of it. What drew the government's attention to you? Of course, we all saw Tahrir Square. We saw the election of Mohamed Morsi, who, of course, had come up with the Muslim Brotherhood. We saw him pushed out, and the military that Mubarak had once headed up come back, essentially back into power. In all of that, what was your role? What drew this military government in its return? What drew their critical attention to you?
I think a number of reasons. One, of course, is that from day one, the military coup took place. I called it as it was, with military coup, brutal and bloody military coup. Many people actually refrained, including the United States of America, refrained from calling it a military coup because of the strategic consequences to something like this. I called it a military coup. I criticized and exposed that regime, and I also had access to the international media, and I managed to get my voice out. And I think, you know, like dictatorships, usually they are concerned about their image, and they are trying to consolidate as quickly and as much as possible in order to gain recognition. And I think that was what General Sisi, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, the current ruler of Egypt, military ruler of Egypt, has been trying to do, to secure as much recognition as possible. Any voice that will undermine this endeavor and will expose the brutality and the mass violations of human rights of that regime, of course, they would quell and try to crush.
Were you a supporter of the Morsi government? Were you part of his, I don't know, kitchen cabinet, think tank?
No. I'm an independent academic scholar, and I always say I like to teach political science than to practice politics. I don't have much liking for politics and the practice of politics as such. But, you know, this is a situation where you teach certain values to your students. As a political scientist, you are trying to make their voices count. And here, all of a sudden, you have a military coup that thwarted a democratic process and repressing any dissent, crushing any voice. So you have to take a stand, because these exactly situations where one has to take a stand. You cannot acquiesce to such brutal measures. Look, let me just, you know, very quickly go over, for example, the inventory of that military regime. In two years, you have over 3,000 Egyptians killed after the military coup. You have 16,000 injured, over 40,000 detained. You have 4,011 cases of civilian cases that were referred to military tribunals and military courts. 300 students dead, killed by police bullets, live bullets, 20 of them on campus. So we really have a very kind of a bloody record of a regime. If you compare that to Chile, for example, Pinochet, it took Pinochet 13 or 17 years to achieve that record. It took Abdel Fattah al-Sisi only 2 years to achieve that record of suppression and of killing the aspirations and the hopes of young Egyptians that rose in 2011 to achieve democracy, to achieve freedom and social justice. And this is what it is all about. Then, you know, like, one has to take a stand. You cannot be silent or just sit on the fence, you know, hesitant whether to call it coup or not coup. Or you see it by the consequences. And these are the consequences, and these are the empirical facts.
We're going to look at the whole region. We're going to look at America's role. I know you have keen thoughts on that. Just to help people bring back to mind all that's happened here. I mean, here first, this was February 2011. There was so much global excitement about those massive crowds in Tahrir Square, forced out, ultimately, the dictator Hosni Mubarak. Here was some of that sound, 2011 February. Elections were ultimately held. Mohamed Morsi came in the first week of July 2013. An estimated 14 million Egyptians, the largest crowds in Egypt's history, out in the streets again, apparently supporting generals and driving Morsi from power. Two crowds, one Tahrir pushing out a military man, another there ended up bringing in the military. And just this month, May 16th, courtroom in Cairo, here's the judge reading out the name of the deposed President Morsi and others, delivering the sentence of death, referring their sentences to the Grand Mufti for approval.
Muhammad Morsi Isa al-Ayyad, Asam al-Din, Muhammad Hussein al-Aryan.
Imad Shaheen, also sentenced to death this month. He got out of Egypt and is with us today. Can you explain what happened? Americans saw Tahrir. It was very inspiring at the time. And then, a couple of years later, we see millions in the streets again, and it ends up with Morsi being pushed out, the generals coming in. What happened there? You call it a simple coup, but there were a lot of people out there.
Yes. Look, Egypt had, as you mentioned, mass upheavals. That unusually they are accompanied by uncertainties, inexperience, and all the insecurities. We also had very rough democratic transition, very rough democratization process. But let's agree on one thing. An imperfect democracy is better than a secure dictatorship. I think that should be the bottom line. And what happens throughout was, of course, the strategic mistakes of many parties involved. On the top, of course, was the Muslim Brotherhood and Morsi's administration that, to a large extent, could not understand the dynamics of the Egyptian state, especially the deep one, and how it worked. It did not side with the demands of the revolution and the revolutionary demands, and it tried to reform from within. And, of course, did not persist on bringing everybody on board. I think this was the one mistake on one side, which is the Muslim Brotherhood. On the other hand, we had also a liberal secular opposition that acted with a coup-like mentality. They acted as spoilers. They tried to make to exert every effort to make the Muslim Brotherhood fail and the rule fail. And also we had the deep state, at the top of which was the security forces and the military establishment that tried to make a comeback, and indeed they managed to and succeeded to do so. The regional environment also was not conducive to that, and the international, to this transition. If you remember, the United States, the Europeans, were extremely patient with people like Mubarak and Ben Ali for 30 years. They tolerated them, they accommodated them, they tried to reform with them, but they were not as patient and as tolerant with a one-year democratic, rough democratic process in Egypt.
Bottom line, has the United States now thrown its lot with the generals? Is that your view?
I can say fully, but you see, this is the problem, and this is exactly the predicament. You see, it's very difficult to exactly identify where the United States lies or stands. And the thing is, it cannot have it both ways. Like, for example, a few weeks ago, President Obama lifted the arms freeze on Egypt, by which, you know, he continued the supply of weapons and arms that this general is using to repress his opponents. So ostensibly, the United States appears as it is funding, aiding, and abetting repression in Egypt. And it cannot have it both ways. Either you come out very publicly and say, yes, we still would like to support dictators in the region, the strong men in the region, including Sisi and the likes, or we support and uphold democratic values. But there's no way you can have it both ways. Unfortunately, the way the Europeans and the United States look at this predicament, this dichotomy of security versus values, in a very dichotomous way, in a very kind of, you know, like really contradictory way, they look at it as if they are mutually exclusive. The way I look at it, they are mutually reinforcing. Democracy reinforces security and not the other way around. And the proof for this is very empirical. Look at the past 6 decades. The United States always opted for the strong man, the likes of Mubarak, the likes of Ben Ali, and so on. And what was the result? It brought us Al-Qaeda, it brought us 9/11, and now it's bringing ISIS to us. This issue of security at the exclusion of democracy and human rights has failed, and we need a new vision. The United States need a new vision for that region, a new formula. The new formula should be based on democracy as a source of stability, not a strongman and tyranny and repression as the basis for security in the region.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with an Egyptian sentenced to death and escaped from Egypt, escaped from the returned military government there, about his country, the mess in the Middle East, and America in the region now and in the future. Imad Shaheen joins us from Washington. He is a serious and seriously accomplished man, editor-in-chief of the Oxford Encyclopedia of Islam and Politics. He has taught and studied all over Johns Hopkins, Notre Dame, Harvard, of course, a very prominent and respected academic in Egypt as well, but now under a death sentence. His home was surrounded a year ago, January, in the night. He escaped now in the U.S., but under a death sentence as of this month. It has been a very dramatic time in Egypt and well beyond. We want to harvest his insights today on this. July 2nd, 2013, vast crowds gathered in Cairo to call for the ouster of the elected president, Mohamed Morsi. He was defiant, saying he was legitimately elected, could not be removed from office, but the very next day he was deposed by Army Chief General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Almost 2 years later, just 10 days ago, he and more than 100 others were sentenced to death. So was Imad Shaheen, my guest today on that day. But here's Morsi.
If the price of safeguarding the legitimacy is my blood, then I am prepared to sacrifice my blood for the sake of stability and security of this homeland.
That was now. That was then. The death sentences have come this month. Not all Egyptians were unhappy with them. The Associated Press went into the streets of Cairo, talked to people about what they thought. Some here approved of even the death sentences.
It's good, this man says. We want the country to calm down and go back to normal. People need to calm down, this man says, and I wish the same sentence to the rest of them, those who are spoiling things for the Egyptian people.
Imad Shaheen joins us from Washington, and Imad, I hope you'll explain that perspective to us. There's a lot we want to learn about Egypt, but step back for a minute. Americans look at this region, and it just looks like it's, you know, as we sometimes say, going to hell in a handbasket here. You see all the troubles in Yemen, Saudi Arabia seems in a tumultuous period now, Iraq, a mess, the Islamic State established with everything that means, Iran, these tough negotiations, we don't know where they're going to go. Syria, a complete mess. Egypt, you say, and we see the problems there now and across North Africa and Libya. What is happening?
The entire region is in turmoil, definitely. I mean, nobody can just deny this. And 2011 was a watershed. It's a threshold that transformed the region from a suppressed, states under totalitarian and repressive regimes. Some of them, not all of them.
2011, the Arab Spring.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So I was referring to the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. And things, we should expect that things will never be the same after the Arab Spring. People rose in millions, seeking, you know, certain values and trying to meet certain aspirations. These aspirations have not been met. For a number of reasons, by the way. Like, I'm not trying to put all the blame, for example, on the outside or the United States. No, there were domestic reasons, mm-hmm, regional reasons, mm-hmm, structural reasons. There were so many reasons that we cannot even have the time. It needs volumes just to explain. The end result is what? A region that's going into turmoil is new with new experiences and a lot of inexperience and little help from the inside and from the outside. This is exactly what we're seeing. Also, we're seeing a severe comeback, pushback from what we call counter-revolutionary elements in the region. Countries like Saudi Arabia, countries like the United Arab Emirates, they have financed counter-revolutions. They have financed oppressors and authoritarian regimes to stay in power. And that's exactly what we're seeing.
Including also Egypt now, would you say?
I'm sorry?
Including Egypt now?
Definitely including Egypt, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, all these, Bahrain, all these countries have, even the inaction in Syria, all these countries have been exposed to massive upheavals and received very little help. Help in what sense? In terms of nation building, in terms of an institutional building.
How does your theory of the Arab Spring as being the pivotal event here explain the Islamic State, ISIS, and the Islamic State?
Excellent. This is an excellent question, because it really relates directly to the emergence of ISIS and all this militant ideology and orientation. If you remember, 2011 undermined, and what it stood for, peacefulness, nonviolent resistance, bottom-up change. All this undermined the rhetoric and the narrative of Al-Qaeda at that time.
Al-Qaeda,
and
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. It undermined their narrative. And it showed that there is other avenues than militancy, armed struggle, and all this and violence. And that avenue was, very simply, peaceful upheavals, massive upheavals that can change and topple regimes. That was the narrative then.
Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri used to say, only violence will change the Middle
East.
And what the Arab Spring seemed to refute that for a time.
Exactly. Now people like ISIS and al-Zawahiri and so on, they will look back on us and just sarcastically and say, haven't we told you so?
You were naive, you little peaceniks in the streets talking about peaceful change. You were foolish.
You are foolish. Democracy is futile. All these nonviolent means against violent, repressive regimes are not going to work. The only thing that works is violence. That's what they are going to say. The only thing that works is a forced change. This is the only thing that works.
But are you really telling us there that it's the young Egyptians who are in Tahrir Square, so idealistic, who are now in the Islamic State?
Some of them, not all of them. Thank God. Thank God, not all of them. But I have to tell you something. If you look around us in many states in the region, the call for violence, the call for escalation is increasing. And this is extremely alarming and needs to be addressed immediately. Immediately. Even on the part of mainstream organizations. To the margin of these organizations, there are elements, especially young elements, that are calling for embracing violence and forceful tactics against regimes. And we see it on Facebook, we see it on Twitter, we see it everywhere.
Do they see ISIS or the Islamic State as a counterweight to the what you would call repressive regimes, to al-Sisi and others?
Temporarily, yes, unfortunately. Temporarily, some. I'm not generalizing here because it's very, mm-hmm, dangerous to generalize. Mm-hmm. Some see this as a simplistic, easy solution that will address their frustration, growing frustration of almost the impossibility of change, inducing change through peaceful means. Look at Egypt, for example. All the avenues for change have been closed down. All the avenues. We have laws, anti-protest laws, right? That, mm-hmm, you know, many people protested, including the icons of the 2011 revolution. And where are they now? In jail, Egyptian jail. Ala Abdel Fattah, Ahmed Douma, Ahmed Maher. I can list names. Mahinour al-Masri, Yara Salam. All of these have been jailed because they are protesting the anti-protest laws. all the Midan, Tahrir, and all these like squares have been closed down. We don't have a parliament until now. 63 journalists are in jail. 63 journalists. It has been unprecedented in Egyptian modern history, to have, you know, to all this number, all this number of journalists at once in jail because, you know, they're expressing or they wrote something that made the regime angry. We have 271 cases of death during detention in Egyption prisons and police stations. I mean,
it's a terrible, terrible record, and we hear it loud and clear. But even so, Imad Shaheen, Americans look at the Islamic State or ISIS, and most will see barbarism, a kind of evil, definitely, a kind of readiness to behead and kill and even rape and rampage across this region. They don't look like saviors to most Americans.
ISIS is a clear aberration. It's abnormality. And actually, if you look at their textbook manifesto, you know what the title of their manifesto is?
No.
The Management of Barbarity. That's exactly what it's called. The Management of Barbarity.
But to some young Muslims, they seem to stand for a potential path towards something good or desirable.
Not good or desirable, but something that can address some kind of, you know, like temporary and immediate needs. Look, ISIS is a product of what? It's a product of mainly three elements. Occupation, marginalization, and state failure. The state failure of good governance, to deliver good governance to people. People would like, you know, like really to live in normal circumstances. And now here a state, or here a so-called state, that's claiming to provide a simplistic and simple solution, where people can fulfill some kind of, you know, like their, some kind of, you know, like whatever, expectations, desires, needs, whatever it is. But by the way, this is very temporary. I usually give this kind of analogy. Look at the Taliban. When the Taliban started to be very popular in the late 90s, and how their popularity started to wane and fade away, because people started to know the reality of the Taliban. The same thing will happen to ISIS. Once these kind of immediate reasons behind the emergence of ISIS disappear, people will start realizing the barbarity, as you said, and the brutal nature of that entity.
A lot of Americans just confused now about what the American role should be here. Went into Iraq, and you say occupation, one of the sources of ISIS itself, not the first to observe this. Imad Shaheen is under a sentence of death in his home country, Egypt. A very respected academic, writer, thinker with us today from Washington calls for you, sir. Jacob in Newport News, Virginia. Jacob, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening. I agree with your guest on quite a bit of everything he's saying. It's like Egypt definitely gave a problem to the United States and us in the United States about how to react to it. I mean, do we react? If we support the person who's already there, then we're working against the Egyptians who want to change. But it was a military coup. If we supported that, obviously that's wrong. So the other option is to arm someone or to invade with some type of troops and instill some type of democracy. We saw that in Afghanistan. And during some of my deployments and other people I was deployed with, we saw in Afghanistan where the Taliban would still be respected by some of the local tribal leaders for much of the reasons he's saying, because they could deliver some type of governance of, they would install some type of justice. We might not see it as justice, but the people there did, when they saw the local government that we were helping to establish couldn't. So I don't think the United States really had any good avenues that were approachable for them that were going to be acceptable.
Jacob, you served in Afghanistan. When you look at the Middle East now.
I served in Iraq.
Excuse me.
My fellow soldiers served in Afghanistan. I'm sorry.
When you look at the Middle East now, how do you think about what the U.S. role ought to be? More involvement, less involvement, a different kind of involvement?
I think history serves to show us that when you have a group of people who want democracy and they're confronted with a group of people who are willing to do violence to them in order to stop them from having the democracy, the choices left are only to engage in violence against those groups. I think that when you have groups like ISIS, the ideas of saying that we will be able to change this through peaceful means simply aren't feasible. Like when you have a group like ISIS, when you have groups who are willing to do that and subjugate other people, the response does end up having to be more violence, unfortunately.
Jacob, thank you for calling. Imad Shaheen, you're listening to an American veteran there of the Iraq War, look at ISIS and say, you know, more in sorrow than anything else is going to take violence to stop this. How do you look at it?
Excellent question and excellent comments, by the way. It's a combination of things. Just let me go back, and because this was raised several times during our conversation, mm-hmm. what the United States should do, embrace its own values. I think this should be a new starting point and a good starting point. Also, the region is going through major transformation. I understand what the veteran has been saying. The region is going through major transformation, and we have to understand that. It's very similar to the post-World War I, not World War II, but World War I period, where you have an old entity disintegrating, and you have the possibility of the emergence of new entities. Well, how do you deal with this? You need a new vision. You need a new formula. You need new frameworks. Can the United States provide this? The United States is trying as much as possible to engage and disengage at the same time, which is very understandable. But ad hoc solutions to major problems, to major transformations, like the ones that the entire region is going through, is not going to work. I think the region needs an international regional conference that will at least see how can we deal with this. We're dealing actually with really core issues, essential issues. We're dealing with states disintegrating, disintegration of nation states. We're dealing also with the danger of the emergence of non-state actors in the region immediately, very soon, that will really take charge and start and will put all of us into a reactive position. So we need really to envision this and actually be think ahead of others.
But what can you do at a conference? I mean, ISIS is not going to attend. Al-Sisi is not going to surrender his position at a conference.
Yes.
The king of Saudi Arabia is not going to suddenly declare democracy in Saudi Arabia.
Definitely. But what you need to do is you maintain some kind of a centrist position. You maintain some kind of common ground agreement on certain values by which you marginalize the extremes. And we all become united on marginalizing the extremes that you referred to. People like ISIS, people like Sisi, all these people that are for blood and for violence and for repression. Because repression breeds violence. That's something that we have to agree on. And this is where the connection between Sisi and ISIS is. That what he's doing by the repression that he's undertaking in Egypt is radicalizing the youth, is radicalizing the region itself. Look what it's happening even in Egypt proper, Sinai, and what happened to Sinai, and what happened to all these radical groups that claim now affiliations with ISIS. He, by radicalizing them, by employing excessive violence, he is indirectly or directly leading to the radicalization and actually giving some kind of new recruits to ISIS. And this has to stop. And that's what a regional conference should do or international conference should do. There are so many things. Also the economy. We should not overlook the economy. The region needs some kind of an economic plan that will address the basic needs. Look at all these systems that are still deeply immersed in corruption and lack of accountability and popular oversight. This has been part of the problem, you know, 2011 and so on. I mean, this has to be addressed, and we cannot keep on, you know, like just patching problems and covering on problems like this. We have really to deal with them all together.
But who and how? I think, with respect, so many Americans at this point are very skeptical about the United States' capacity to be the actor or even a central actor here after so many different angles of, you know, attempted intervention, real intervention, and everything that we look at right now in front of us. We want to learn. We're glad you're with us. Imad Shaheen, he's under a death sentence in Egypt, a highly respected academic here in the United States now, talking with On Point today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking this hour with an Egyptian sentenced to death and escaped from Egypt, escaped from the returned military government there, talking about his country, the mess in the Middle East, and America in the region now and in the future. Imad Shaheen is with us from Washington, visiting professor now, political science, School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He's been at Notre Dame and Harvard, studied at Johns Hopkins, his PhD there, American University in Cairo, highly respected, editor-in-chief of the Oxford Encyclopedia of Islam and Politics, but in trouble with the military government now in Egypt. Lots of response online here. Check it out. But Ari says, decades of billions, I guess from the United States, never made them democratic, and decades of billions from the Soviets never made them communist. So you people take the term superpower way, way, way too literally. Tebaba is calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Tebaba, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for this opportunity. Thank you, Tom.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. What's your thought?
And my question is for your guest is, I would like to know, I mean, what is the difference between the Muslim Brotherhood and this government? Because he's trying to tell us that this government is a dictatorship government. But when after the Muslim Brotherhood took the position in the Egyptian government, they started to suppress the Egyptian Christians. And they try to lead the country with the theocratic government system. And the most of Egyptian Christians, the women, girls, they were raped. And if you remember, the St. George Church was burned. Even another evangelical churches were burned and looted. And there were many, many other cases.
Tebaba, we do remember. If I may, let me put it to Imad Shaheen. We have others as well, Imad, online saying, you know, this is a choice between, what do you want, a secular autocracy, Sisi, or a theocratic autocracy, Muslim Brotherhood? And our caller sounds like maybe happier with Sisi.
Neither. We don't want any one of these. What we want is a democratic system where people's rights are protected, minorities included, as the gentleman has referred to, and also where people have a full sense of participation and full rights of participation, respect of human rights, respect of rule of law. That's exactly what we want. Now, for the past periods, as I mentioned earlier, Egypt went through really tough transition, and there were many hands playing into the whole process. In terms of destabilization, in terms of really shaking the ground of any kind of civilian government. My preference, as I mentioned, is that is for civilian rule, not military rule. And I feel more secure under civilian rule than military rule. If there were some kind of alleged atrocities has taken place, that's exactly what we are calling for. Let's now start a transitional process. Let's start a transitional justice where all these files, all these grievances would be reviewed starting from the time of Mubarak until now. And from now until we go backward to the time of Mubarak. But I'm sure one day there will be a process of transitional justice that will take place. And all these atrocities, all these claims, all these wrongdoings will be revealed until we reach to some level of national reconciliation in the end.
What is going to bring that day? It sounds marvelous, but also it sounds, as we sit here right now, it sounds utopian, as if the whole region is going to become Geneva or The Hague. I mean, there are real powers at play
South Africa or Chile or Brazil or Argentina or Spain. You see, all of these countries that you mentioned went exactly through the same process. Mm-hmm. Military juntas, military rule, repression for years, for decades. And then what happened? The military dictatorships collapse. And they are bound to collapse because you cannot rule by repression all the time. This is the 21st century. And we have, it's not utopian, but it's hope.
But will it collapse to you and others who would bring democracy and this kind of secular justice, or will it collapse to some element of the Islamic State reaching out, even in Egypt's direction?
You see, this is exactly where we are trying to avoid. We are trying to avoid extremes. What we need is a change, a democratic change. Now, the way it is, it seems now like many young will look at this option. Okay, why don't we just make it and struggle for an Islamic state, something like Iran, something like, you know, like a purely Islamic revolution. Mm-hmm. This is what we really are trying to avoid. We need a democratic revolution. Revolution in terms of reform, in terms of severing ties and making really clean breaks with the past, old regime. The authoritarian regime, state security, we need restructuring and so on. That's exactly what we are trying to do. We are trying to stick to the mainstream, to the middle ground, and not to go to the extremes. Some people, of course, with these measures that Sisi is implementing and his regime, he's pushing us to the extreme, which we are trying really as much as possible to prevent.
Are you guys history now? I mean, maybe it's settling into a kind of a big war scenario. People talk about that, where you'll have your entrenched dictators, if you like, versus Islamic State on its warpath, and everybody dukes it out.
No, it's well-entrenched dictatorships versus democratic rule and democratic government. And we are not history. History is beginning. History is beginning in Egypt. Look, if you look at these upheavals, 2011, as just, you know, one episode and it's over, no. Revolutions come in waves. And this is exactly one wave after another wave after another wave. Things will never be the same in the Middle East. Look, the region is young, and there is the force of demography. 65% of the region under the age of 35. So this is the future of that region. And the future is for democracy, for rule of law, for human rights, not for dictatorships. And even by the force of democracy, that will prevail at one day. I mean, these kind of young, youthful aspirations will prevail. I know it sounds very utopian. It sounds very, you know, like emotional and everything. But we have to keep the hope, because hope is the thing that changes nations and changes states.
Let's go to Rich calling from Milwaukee. Rich, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, my name is Vic.
Thank you, Vic. Thank you for calling.
Yeah. How are you folks doing? Very interesting topic. I grew up in the Sudan. I was born there. My father was a university professor for 30 years. And I went through the cycle that we're talking about, the Arab Spring that we're talking about. I think our guests will be aware that Sudan had a dictator called Mohamed Nimeiri. Mm-hmm. He was kind of a U.S. ally. Supported, you know, he was a dictator, and then he was overthrown, and there were huge democratic protests in Sudan in 1983-84 time frame.
Yeah,
I remember that because I was 13 years old and I participated in the overthrow of the dictator and bringing democracy.
And what did you learn from it all, Vic?
You know, what I really learned, you know, I am ethnically from India, and we are believe in democracy. It's in our blood. We very much believe in democracy. And what I learned, you know, growing up there and participating in this is that, you know, it's not easy. It's not easy for countries that have been in repression and under control. And even if they have good intentions, sometimes they're not successful. And it really becomes the job of mature democracies. I would say even India, even the U.S., you know, yeah, and let's say European countries that are mature democracies to come in and help and foster and grow that. You know, teach them from our mistakes that we have learned. I sincerely believe the U.S. Constitution is a human experiment that works, but we made our mistakes over here and we learned from them.
But George W. Bush, Vic, talked about model democracy in Iraq, and we went in a very, very large way. And look at that today.
No, we did not. No.
Well, we were certainly there with a very, very large footprint for a long time.
We went in, but that's not the way to do democracy. You don't go in with a military and say, I'm going to install democracy in a country. Nobody's going to trust you. Nobody's going to be with you. You don't go in with a military of 500,000 people, the most advanced military in the world, and say, I'm going to install democracy.
So what do you do? We've had Americans thrown in prison in Egypt just for talking about democracy without guns.
Right. I mean, I think the way you do it is countries that make this turn, like Sudan did in 1983-84, if that government was actually mentored and supported and shown and guided with good intentions, I think we wouldn't have had Darfur. I don't think we would have had this North and South war that that has happened there, I think a lot of this could have been avoided because inherently, you know, Sudanese people, I grew up over there. We had zero crime. We had no problems. And all of a sudden, one day, the fanatics took over and everything went to hell.
Vic, let me bring it to Ahmad Shaheen. Professor Shaheen, did Mohamed Morsi, when he was elected president of Egypt, did he want mentoring from the United States?
Look, I have not been close to his administration at all, just to know the extent of his relationship with the United States. All what I know is the United States, I think, has given him the opportunity and the chance, but they were not patient enough. That's all what I know. I fully agree with Vic about, you know, his views about the limits of outside powers and what they can do. Democracy has to be homegrown. This is something that has to develop from within and has to evolve from within. Nations are and people are bound to make mistakes, but as I fully agree with him that a little help from the outside can be of great use. However, when it comes to specifically, because that was raised several times, what the United mm-hmm. States can do, at least you do not reward dictators. You do not reward repression. And I think that's what seems to many people now. You know, look, Egypt is the largest recipient, one of the largest recipients of U.S. Foreign aid, mm-hmm. $1.3 billion or something like that. I'm not going to sever this or not, but at least try to give some kind of incentive, pressure, call it whatever you call it, to the military establishment in Egypt to try to reform itself from within, to take at least one step back. I fully agree with Vic. It's not going to be overnight. It has to be a gradual process, a trial and error process. We learn from that, but it has to start. Mm-hmm. But if we just, you know, conduct business as usual, that, you know, we keep rewarding dictators for their human rights abuse just in case that they can reform later on, this will never work.
And do you think the Obama administration is doing that now?
Definitely it is. Definitely it is. There was some kind of a conditional contingencies on the resumption of arms and so on and aid to Egypt based on the roadmap and so on. And so far, nothing, you know, like little has been achieved. Mm. And when it comes to human rights abuse and violations, it has been massive, massive. And yet they are rewarded. The repressive regime is rewarded.
Mm. Let me go to Ezra, if I may, calling from Boston. Ezra, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
You're welcome. Masal khair, Ustaz Ahmed. I'm calling from Boston. I'm Egyptian.
Yes.
I have been in America for a year. I was one of the young people who went to the Tahrir Square when the revolution started.
To Tahrir Square, yes, okay.
Yes, and I came from my small town, Rosetta. It's near to Alexandria, and I stayed in Cairo until Hosni Mubarak kicked out.
Yep.
And after that, I got frustrated because 3 years and the situation in Egypt is getting worse. And I was working in college. I was teaching in college in Egypt, Alexandria University.
Yep.
And they fired me because I got married for an American guy and he doesn't have residency in Egypt. So I tried to take vacation to come to America. They fired me from college, and I think it was political decision
Ezra, what should the United States do now in Egypt, in this region, Ezra?
I think United States, Egyptian people, people who can make the changes. So I found everything corruption in Egypt, corruption in college. Corruption, everything. What we can do, we are youth people. We don't have good jobs. We don't have good futures. A lot of us don't have jobs. And I think I came to America and I'm worried about my country. But I think United States has a role in Middle East. But I think that people who live in their country, they will do first step.
Egyptians need to take the first step. As our time grows very short, I wish you luck and I appreciate your call. Imad, it's so big it's hard to get our arms around. I don't think the people will be satisfied with your notion of holding a conference. But for a big strategy, America seems to be looking for a new one here. Some people say, pull away. We have not had a good impact. If it's not pull away, how would the U.S. effectively lean in at this point?
As I mentioned earlier, do not reward oppressors and dictators. Try to stick to good American values of democracy and upholding human rights standards. For the time being, I think this would be good enough.
What about the Islamic State? What should the American response be?
A combination of security measures as well as economic, political measures. Look, we need to prioritize the problems. Now we have really a serious issue of disintegration of nation states. We need to rebuild political infrastructures that can integrate and can incorporate different people and stop excluding them. This is really a major issue that needs to be addressed. And we really need to start working on truly representative systems that will include everyone, at least, because these problems will not go away without finding these solutions.
Is Egypt a candidate for this rebirth? It has not looked like it lately.
Not under the military. Military coups do not build democracies.
I guess that's a fair and inarguable statement from human experience. Egyptians facing a tough road there, and Americans facing a very murky situation about how exactly to do something that's helpful and not the reverse. Emma Shaheen, you're very good to be with us today. We're grateful to you. We wish you luck. We hope this death sentence somehow is removed from you. Maybe the Grand Mufti will have a hand in that. We wish you luck to you and your family. Thank you, and good luck in all of your work and future.
Thank you very much for having me.
Emad Shaheen, joining us from Washington, under death sentence in Egypt, scholar, and you hear his view. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.